listening to Sasha and Marsh with the tune Dead Cynthia. Clock, Max Amorth, before that with Stopping from the Piano Swag EP. We also had Animal Friend, before that was Stoken, the Sleight of Hands remix. I'm DJ Firefly. You've been listening to Couch Dancing on WRCT Pittsburgh. That's about it for this show. If you want to get in touch with me if you missed a show, my website is at djfirefly.com.
Is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we get an update on the litigation being pursued by the American Civil Liberties Union that challenges a range of dangerous policies being pushed through by the Trump administration.
Our guest, Ben Weisner, Deputy Legal Director of the ACLU and Director of the ACLU's Center for Democracy, walks us through several legal cases brought to protect free speech, privacy, immigrants' rights, and human rights. We're then joined by Professors Luz Herrera and Nancy Planky Videla. They're part of a team that published the report on the Mexican Reintegration Project study.
This rare perspective details the socioeconomic and cultural impacts people experience when deported back to Mexico.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
The very day Donald Trump returned to the White House on January 20, 2025, the American Civil Liberties Union celebrated the beginning of its 106th year. Based on its long experience combating repressive governments, the ACLU had been carefully planning for the possibility of Trump's reelection. That day it announced that it was fully prepared for the threat Trump posed to our constitutional democracy. During the first Trump administration, the ACLU took legal action more than 430 times. In the last 6 months of this year, they have followed a clear playbook to fight back and win, challenging a wide range of Trump's policies that are aimed at destroying our civil rights and civil liberties. To discuss all this and to get an update on what the ACLU is doing to fight back, we're very pleased to be joined again by Ben Weisner, Deputy Legal Director of the ACLU and Director of the ACLU's Center for Democracy, which encompasses the organization's work on free speech, privacy, immigrant rights, voting rights, human rights, and national security. For more than two decades at the ACLU, Ben has litigated cases involving the right to protest, freedom of expression online, government surveillance practices, airport security policies, targeted killings, and torture. Since July of 2013, he has been the principal legal advisor to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and has advised Julian Assange. I've known Ben personally since he started at the ACLU of Southern California over 20 years ago. I witnessed how he devotes his keen legal mind and deep compassion to defending the people he represents who are struggling to vindicate their constitutional rights. Ben Weisner, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Steve, thank you so much for inviting me back. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Ben, first let's look at the big picture. In the last 6 months, how many legal actions of all types has the ACLU, both nationally and in its more than 50 affiliates around the country, brought against the Trump administration? How many ACLU lawyers are working on these cases? And do you have an estimate of how many temporary restraining orders, preliminary injunctions, and final judgments the ACLU has been winning so far?
I will confess, I don't love the term legal actions. I think it's a bit of a PR term that allows us to inflate the numbers just a little bit. It includes things like FOIA requests. But let's just talk about lawsuits. In the first 100 days of the Trump administration, we filed more than 50 actual lawsuits, and the number now is over 80 in the first 6 months of the Trump administration. And that is a mind-boggling number when you consider that we are under 100 lawyers in the national ACLU, maybe another 150 or so if you include the entire affiliate network that we have. And if you compare this to the Department of Justice, which has 11,000 lawyers, you can see why many of my colleagues have spent their nights and weekends on office couches. In terms of our success rate, it's been incredibly high. And I know there's a lot of focus on the cases where the administration is toying with court orders, threatening to defy them, being defiant and disrespectful of judicial authority. But in almost 80% of the cases in which we have sought preliminary relief, either a temporary restraining order or a preliminary injunction, we have prevailed and gotten that relief. And so, look, there's a lot to complain about when we talk about today's federal judiciary. That's been true throughout my career, but more so now. But I'm here to say that litigation has still been an extremely effective tool for us.
Well, Ben, unfortunately, many ACLU victories are facing a hostile reception in the Supreme Court. For example, in Trump versus CASA, without reaching the merits of Trump's wholesale attack on birthright citizenship, the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision, severely restricted the ability of U.S. district courts to issue nationwide injunctions. But the ACLU has been able to fight back by means of a class action. Please explain the importance of nationwide injunctions, what the majority on the court did in CASA, what the three dissenting judges had to say, and most importantly, how the ACLU and others are refusing to give up the fight to protect newborn citizens on a nationwide basis.
Well, let's start with birthright citizenship before we get to the question of injunctions, because I want to make sure that your listeners understand that Trump's unconstitutional birthright citizenship executive order has not taken effect. And I am telling you now, it will not take effect, despite the Supreme Court's ruling in the CASA case. There are many ongoing challenges to the birthright citizenship order, including two from the ACLU, one that was argued last week in the First Circuit Court of Appeals. This issue will be back in the Supreme Court in the next term, this time to consider the merits of the question whether the president, by the stroke of a pen, can overrule the 14th Amendment. I predict the answer will be a resounding no. And that Trump will be lucky if he gets two votes on the Supreme Court for that extreme position. But as you pointed out, the Supreme Court took the occasion of the first time that this case was before them to really weaken the ability of lower courts, most federal courts, to enforce the Constitution and to rein in violations of federal law. The question, which is an interesting academic question in the abstract, is when should we allow one district judge in one district to essentially make policy for the whole country? And this isn't really a partisan issue. I think there were a lot of complaints from progressives when conservative lawyers would forum shop into a single judge district in Texas in order to block policies of the Obama administration or the Biden administration that then had to be taken up on appeal. But the idea that we should be having this civil procedure debate during the Trump administration just shows how out of touch Justice Barrett and the rest of the Supreme Court majority really is. Because the Trump administration has given so many indications that it doesn't respect the rulings of lower courts. It went so far as to say in the oral argument in this case, it didn't consider itself necessarily bound even by federal appellate courts without Supreme Court affirmation. And so the Supreme Court essentially created a situation where the Trump administration could lose in a court of appeals and choose not to seek cert in the Supreme Court and then not consider itself bound around the country to follow that kind of law. And the fact that they did it in the birthright citizenship case, where the constitutional question is so open and shut, was particularly outrageous. But as you said in your question, there are still many ways for us to enforce the law. The class action mechanism is available on the very day that the Supreme Court issued its decision in CASA. That afternoon, we filed a new lawsuit, a class action lawsuit, and that class was certified, and an injunction was issued, a class-wide injunction. And so that's why I say this, the birthright citizenship order is not going to take effect. But when you combine this restriction on the authority of lower court judges to enjoin unconstitutional activities with this increasing practice of the Supreme Court to make law on its shadow docket, on appeals from injunctions, without full briefing and argument, without even necessarily reasoned opinions, you'll see that getting compliance with the Constitution has never been procedurally more difficult than it is right now. I think that this will be less a problem for organizations like the ACLU, full of sophisticated litigators. We always have one or two or three strategies in our pocket. We're always prepared for these kinds of obstacles. But the court has definitely made litigation more of a puzzle for litigators who don't have our experience.
Well, let's turn to that shadow docket, as it's called. As never before, the conservative majority on the court is using emergency stays to hand Trump an unbroken series of victories, blocking injunctions that have been granted by federal district judges, often with the approval of the appellate courts. They're creating what I've called a kind of law-free zone during this period. They're not maintaining the status quo, they're disrupting it. Tell us what's so unprecedented about these emergency stays and why, in your view, it undermines the rule of law.
First, I want to say that the Trump administration's record here is not unbroken. The ACLU has prevailed already in a number of cases, even on the shadow docket, for example, in our litigation over the Alien Enemies Act, where twice the Supreme Court took our side on the shadow docket. First, making very clear that people who are picked up under this 18th century law have the ability to have a process to determine whether they are in fact members of this Venezuelan gang, and second, even to challenge the legality of the designation in the first place. So we have, even in this very difficult way of litigating, we have had some victories and will continue to have some victories. But essentially, this is making the Supreme Court a court of general appeal. The Supreme Court only takes 65 or so cases a year where it hears full briefing and argument. But if it's going to consider hundreds more on, you know, emergency appeals of injunctions and make very sweeping and important decisions without having the opportunity for the parties really to air out their positions, to present their full cases, and then also to make those decisions without even reasoned opinions in many of these cases, it starts to look like rule by fiat rather than rule of law. You know, again, particularly now that the court has essentially said that except in extraordinary circumstances, we don't want lower courts issuing broad injunctions. The court is essentially directing all of that litigation to itself, but through this mechanism that doesn't allow the court to consider all of the equities and to consider all of the implications of its ruling. It's essentially aggrandizing even more authority to itself, saying even if we can only write long opinions in 65 cases a year, we're going to make sure we more closely police what the many hundreds of other federal judges around the country, the careful work that they're doing, and sometimes to summarily reverse it. So, look, I don't know what we can do about this. The court, you know, generally has the authority to set its own procedures. The best thing that we can do is wholeheartedly and with, you know, all of our might, defend the preliminary injunctive relief that we get in lower courts. As I said before, so far, our record is pretty solid on some of these cases, so we don't consider it a loss just when the government, you know, takes up a case on the shadow docket. But it is something that we as a society and maybe Congress, if we had one, would look at in deciding, you know, what kind of procedures our federal court should have.
What is the role that the dissenters are playing on these emergency stays. While the majority writes a one-paragraph order, the dissenters are explaining what's wrong with those decisions. Tell us about some of those dissents and the role that it's playing in upholding the rule of law.
I mean, I identify very strongly with those dissenters. You know, Steve, I was born in 1971. 1971 was the last year that the Supreme Court had a liberal majority. So for my entire lifetime, not just for my professional career, but for my whole life, civil rights and civil liberties litigators have been battling uphill. What you can say about dissents, both on the shadow docket and elsewhere, and I would add to that about cases that we bring that can't prevail, is that we're building a record. We're building a record for future courts and lawyers, for historians. We're building a record for the day that we might have one of these post-Watergate moments and we might have an opportunity to have sweeping progressive reforms on some of these issues. We're building a record that is valuable in international forums, that's valuable in other countries. And I think we're also modeling the kind of compassionate reasoning that represents our Constitution's best traditions. So, you know, when you have these extremely well-reasoned, passionate dissents without any opinion that they're responding to in the first place, I think it can be even valuable for lower courts when these issues go back down. If the Supreme Court's conservative supermajority doesn't want to explain its position, that might, one hopes, at least weaken the precedential value of the order that they're making. And I hope that lower courts will look at these dissents from Justices Kagan and Sotomayor and Ketanji Brown Jackson and take some guidance for those as they cases go forward in the lower courts.
Well, Ben Wisner, we want to ask you next about a few policy areas in which Trump has issued executive orders and where officials within his administration have implemented them, and ask you how the ACLU has designed its legal strategies to expose how the Constitution and laws passed by Congress are being violated. And I'd like to start with immigration and ICE enforcement.
Yeah, well, we could spend the rest of our time on this issue alone, obviously, because it has been the centerpiece of the Trump administration's rights violations and as well as our response. But on the president's first day in office, we've already mentioned the Birthright Citizenship Executive Order that he signed. The ACLU filed the first lawsuit challenging that within hours. We now have two lawsuits challenging that. I think it's extremely unlikely that the president will prevail in this attempt to rewrite the 14th Amendment. There is square Supreme Court precedent on point, but it was a signal. Business was not usual, and the Trump administration was going to try extraordinary and extra legal tactics in order to push its mass deportation agenda. I think some of the most important litigation that we're involved in involves our cases challenging the president's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act. Remember, this is a 18th century statute that under which the president can designate an entity a foreign enemy of the United States. And of course, the strategy here is if you want to deport a million people a year, that's pretty difficult to do if those people might have access to lawyers, be able to bring their cases before immigration judges. Just as a practical matter, the government doesn't have the resources to process that number of cases. And so that's why they're trying to come up with legal strategies that will allow them to circumvent those fundamental due process requirements, to deport people en masse, to round them up, put them on buses and put them on planes without any judge or lawyer having an opportunity to intervene. And so that issue, as I mentioned, has already been to the Supreme Court twice on the shadow docket. We have habeas cases, class actions in multiple jurisdictions on that issue. And I would predict that in 2026, the core questions there, whether the president can invoke this authority, and if so, what process is due to people who are swept up under the invocation, will be back before the Supreme Court. Steve, since you're in Los Angeles, I want to point out the incredible work that the ACLU of Southern California did in response to the awful raids that have taken place there and the protests that followed. The affiliate filed two lawsuits, one of them challenging the raids themselves and the lack of basic respect for the Fourth Amendment. The clear racial profiling that was involved in those sweeps. ICE tactics were enjoined by a federal judge in Los Angeles. The Ninth Circuit left that in place, and now the Trump administration is going to the Supreme Court on the shadow docket to try to lift that injunction. But it shows that this is an effort that requires both our national litigators and our affiliates that are closer to the ground to see how these policies are actually being implemented. And Maria, I could go through another dozen immigration cases that we're involved in, but I will let you move us on to the next issue.
Well, let's do that because we have so many issues to cover because the ACLU is covering so many issues. How about Trump's attacks on free speech, campus protest, and academic freedom?
These are some of the cases that are closest to my heart and the ones that I'm, you know, in some sense most nervous about losing. You know, as you know, we represent four students and professors who were arrested off the street by plainclothes officers, bundled into vans and planes and flown to Louisiana or Texas simply for political speech. One of them, Rumeysa Ozturk, co-wrote an op-ed in the Tufts Daily newspaper. Others were involved in various kinds of protest activity. I can say happily that all four of them, Mahmoud Khalil, Rumeysa Ozturk, Dr. Badr Khan Suri, and Mohsen Madawi, have been ordered released by federal judges because of ACLU litigation. But the attempts to deport them on the basis of their political speech are ongoing in the immigration courts. So we've obtained their liberty, but we have not yet gotten rid of the immense constitutional threat. I mean, I did not expect to see this in our country, people literally being bundled off and locked away simply because of things they said with no allegation of illegality whatsoever. So those are very important. We're able to assemble a cross-ideological group of amici, including libertarian groups like the Cato Institute and others, to join us in a brief supporting Harvard in its lawsuit against the Trump administration. The Trump administration essentially attempted an outrageous takeover of Harvard's curriculum, of its faculty hiring, of its admissions processes, cut off or threatened to cut off billions of dollars of federal funding unless Harvard would essentially turn over the whole university to a Trump administration commissar. However that case resolves itself, the fact that Harvard brought that lawsuit was really, I think, quite significant in changing the kinds of incentives that elite actors have, because Harvard was almost universally praised for standing up. So I think that was a very important litigation that we have supported as friends of the court.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm Steve Rohde, and my co-host is Maria Hall. Today, we're joined by Ben Wisner, the Deputy Legal Director of the ACLU. Ben, moving on to the area of voting rights, what has the ACLU been doing?
Well, so far we saw an executive order from the Trump administration purporting to require the Election Assistance Commission to require documentary proof of citizenship to register to vote. We and others challenged the legality of this, obtained a preliminary injunction, and that injunction is in place now pending appeal.
And how about DEI? Tell us what the ACLU has been doing in the face of Trump's efforts to dismantle diversity, equity, and inclusion.
And this has really cut across a lot of our litigation and issue areas because this encompasses censorship and funding and so. But I'll just give a few highlights here. Following one of the executive orders, the National Institute for Health cut all research grants that included topics or words like gender ideology, DEI, or even vaccine hesitancy, COVID. We brought a lawsuit claiming that that was illegal and unconstitutional. A federal judge in Boston said that in his 40 years on the bench, he had never seen anything so blatantly racially discriminatory as the cuts in this case. And we've obtained an injunction blocking enforcement of that executive order. Of course, it is now before the Supreme Court on its shadow docket, and we'll see what happens there. But this cuts across other areas. The National Endowment for the Arts promulgated a rule that in order to apply for arts funding, applicants had to denounce gender ideology, and we obtained an injunction blocking the enforcement of one. We represent medical researchers whose peer-reviewed articles were taken down from a patient safety website because they included forbidden terms like LGBTQ, and we got an injunction requiring all of those to be restored. So there has been so much unconstitutional censorship as a result of these DEI-related executive orders, but so far our record in challenging them is pretty strong.
Ben, many people are concerned that we're in a constitutional crisis. Given your long decades of work, how would you assess this period we're living through? How do you personally feel about the resilience and the very future of our democracy and the Constitution itself?
You know, I've thought a lot about this question, Steve. When you and I first met a quarter century ago, I mean, remember my first day at the ACLU was a month before 9/11. And many of the cases that we had to litigate then involved black sites, forced disappearance, torture, creating islands outside the law, whether citizens could be killed without any kind of legal process. So it's not the first time, even in my legal career, that we've had to deal with this question of, you know, what kind of democracy is this? Are there rules that can constrain the executive branch? What kind of immunities can protect this kind of illegal conduct? But I will say that the last 6 months have been pretty unique in terms of just the sheer pace, the sheer vandalism involved in trying to wreck our institutions and trying to wreck our constitutional norms. You know, as a litigator, I ask the question, is litigation still working? My answer for now is yes. If we were to reach a point where we thought litigation were futile, we would yell that everybody should just be out in the streets. Now, I think people should be in the streets anyway, but we're not at a point where I think that our system has broken. I do think that our institutions are stronger than Trump and his cronies believe they are. I think that America is not a country that is so easily converted into an autocracy because we have such a strong civil society. We still have a free media in this country. And I also like to turn this question around, because asking whether we're in a constitutional crisis in some sense suggests that we're being acted upon. And I think the answer to that question really resides with us. If every law firm that is targeted by an illegal executive order capitulates, it's contributing to a crisis. If every university that is targeted with an illegal takeover order capitulates, we're contributing to a crisis. And you can go across other institutions as well. We'll decide whether this is a crisis or not. And I've been really heartened by the fierce response from civil society, including the ACLU and our partner organizations to this onslaught. I've been heartened by the judiciary, which apart from the Supreme Court, has been deeply offended by the Trump administration's assault on the rule of law. And we see judges being educated before our eyes in the course of this litigation. So look, I don't want to be Pollyannish. What law can do is limited. We can throw sand in the gears. We can mitigate and slow down the worst harms. But ultimately, it's going to be up to the people through elections and other expressions of their views to decide what kind of country this is.
Ben, you mentioned lawsuits are one way to overcome what Trump is doing. But beyond litigation, what else is the ACLU doing to defend democracy?
We're doing a number of things and fighting on multiple fronts. We have a campaign called Firewall for Freedom, where we're working with blue state governors and mayors and legislatures to try to enact policies to protect their own citizens from the worst depredations of the Trump administration's onslaught. Through our people power, we're trying to organize people to be involved in demonstrations, to participate in protests, to be involved in Know Your Rights. This is a full society effort. It's a full government onslaught on us, and it's going to take all of us pushing back. I mean, the ACLU was a proud sponsor of the No Kings protest, where we saw some 5 million Americans peacefully protesting, in contrast to the Trump administration sending the Marines into the middle of Los Angeles for no reason. And I think ultimately this is a battle for public opinion. And people see the contrast between an administration that is trying to inflame rather than calm civil unrest and peaceful protesters who are expressing in a respectful way their outrage about what's happening in this country. So I do think mobilizing people to be more directly involved in many ways is a part of what the ACLU is doing and needs to do.
Ben, how can listeners follow and support the work of the ACLU?
Our website gets better and better, Steve. www.aclu.org will give you all of the information and all the links to ways to support us, whether it's financially or by getting involved through our People Power initiatives or multiple other ways. Please follow and support our work.
Ben, thank you so much, not just for joining us on Law and Disorder, but literally for everything you do every day in the cause of justice and equality in this country.
And thank you, Steve, for helping to shine a light on it.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Immigration news continues to dominate headlines. From the approval of $170 billion additional dollars for immigration enforcement, to images of men with covered faces in unmarked vehicles roaming around cities like Houston, Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, looking for immigrants to meet rumored quotas, and arresting people from homes, workplaces, and even off the street. Now, these controversial tactics haven't been a total success. Court battles, community opposition, and even ICE officer burnout are hindering the Trump administration's deportation goals. But still, for millions of non-citizens living in the United States, it's impossible not to wonder, what happens if I, or my loved one, is taken from our family and home without notice and transplanted to a country where we no longer have roots or safety? Our guests today, Professor Luz Herrera and Nancy Planky Videla, are among a team of researchers who studied what happens when people are deported or otherwise return to Mexico after creating a home and community in the U.S. Were they able to find work, reunite with family, find support? Luz Herrera is an attorney and professor at Texas A&M University Law School. Her roots are in Los Angeles. In 2005, she co-founded Community Lawyers, Inc. in Compton, which, even now, 20 years later, continues to provide access to justice and legal help to underserved communities. Dr. Nancy Planky Videla is Associate Professor of Sociology at Texas A&M University and is currently the director of the Latino, Latina, and Mexican American Studies Program. She's also the director of graduate studies in the Sociology Department and has a joint appointment in the School of Law. Luz Herrera and Nancy Planky Videla, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
So before getting into the details of the study, Nancy, can you explain in broad strokes the actual deportation process when the United States government drops someone off on the Mexican side of the border? For example, where are they taken? Who are they with? And do they have any money, food, or belongings?
There are 11 sites on the border, plus Mexico City, where people in removal proceedings are dropped off. They're really dropped off at the bridge and let through a door, and there on the other side should be the Institute of National Immigration to receive them and give them documents and help them process paperwork. However, we found that 17% of the times those offices were closed because people were deported in the middle of the night, and so they could not get essential documents they needed to start a life back home. They usually have the clothes they have on. Sometimes they have their belongings back, which would include phone and money, but we found that often that was not the case. People were dropped off with nothing but what they had on, and so they had no way to identify themselves. They had no way to call their families. Many did not know phone numbers. We're so used to using cell phones today that they had no contact information to be able to call family or friends on the U.S. side of the border. So they were dropped off in very poor conditions.
Luce, your study is called the Mexican Reintegration Project. When and why did you decide to research what happens to people after they are back in Mexico? And what do you mean by that word reintegration in this context?
Thank you for that question. The way that this idea came about was really my interaction with DACA students when I worked at UCLA, and just observing and experiencing with them so much of the angst that they dealt with on a day-to-day. One time I asked a student who was my research assistant, I said, you know, have you ever thought about going back to Mexico? And she got very upset with me at that question, and at that time I didn't fully understand it. But upon reflection, I realized that I'm coming from a very privileged place where I do have family in Mexico that are, you know, in stable economic situations, and that that person may not have the same family connections and economic stability in another country. And so I really wanted to understand more about what it meant for these people to return or to be deported. And so that was the basis of the study. And when we talk about reintegration, it really looks at what is it that folks need to fit into Mexican society. That includes finding work, getting education, having a social circle, a family circle. And so what we did find was that those who had stronger ties may be more willing and able to return than those who don't.
Well, Nancy, let me ask you this question. Tell us about the participants you studied, their situations and their demographics, and also, of course, how you found them.
We had originally designed a study where we would go to Mexico and contact deported and returned people through non-governmental organizations and government offices. But the pandemic happened. So what we did was, with permission from the University Institutional Review Board, post a flyer of our study on the website of a couple of nonprofits, and it spread like wildfire. Very soon, people were contacting us that had nothing to do with the nonprofits, that didn't even know about them. Our flyer even arrived at the airport in the hands of people just being deported. And so this meant that we interviewed a much larger group than we expected, and with a greater variety of experiences. Some who had not had time to reintegrate but had just arrived, and some who had been there up to 10 years. We know that deportation is a raced and gendered process. Almost all of deported persons are men, and most of them are Latina, even though the same proportions are not present in the undocumented population. And ours was no different. 88% of the deported individuals were men, but only 47% of the returned individuals. These are people who are either following a deported family member or have had such a difficult time in the U.S. that decide to go back. And here we see almost half and half women and men. We also find that people had all levels of education, though the majority had high school, and English proficiency was quite high. So language ability really makes a difference. The better and more native sounding you are, the easier it is to get a job with call centers, which are among the best jobs available in terms of pay. So when you are calling Verizon or a real estate service, we found that often these were deported individuals in Mexico answering the phone and giving you assistance.
Luce, can you give us a sense of the scope of this study? Overall, how many people answered your questions? Was there any demographic differences across the study? During what time period was the study, since immigration dynamics can change from time to time? And finally, what kinds of questions did you ask?
I can address the types of questions we asked, but the previous question, the first question, is probably best answered by Nancy. So the questions that we asked participants in the study really identified with identity issues, so who they were they female, male, how old were they, family composition, both in the United States and in Mexico, their U.S. migration story, their work history, their skill set, deportation and return, any legal redress, right? So did they have any cases filed in the United States related to wage theft or other issues, possibly custody matter. We also asked them about their physical, emotional, and mental health when they arrived in Mexico, at the time. And remember that we were at a time, a lot of these interviews were done during COVID. We asked about their living situation, their identification, right? Whether they had identification in Mexico, because that became quickly, as we began these interviews, an issue that was critical to the reintegration of these individuals. And we also asked about their future plans mainly focused on whether they would try to return to the United States or remain in Mexico, and what that life would look like. To go back to your question, we had over 300 subjects that participated. We did have a variety of individuals that participated. We focused a lot on making sure we had a good sample of women and individuals in rural areas, because those are often underrepresented or not discussed in prior studies. But I did point to Nancy as the one answering those questions, because she has the actual number. We had to go through a number of processes to identify what the right number was based on the data we gathered. So Nancy, you remember the actual number of subjects that we interviewed?
We interviewed 326 individuals who lived in 22 out of the 32 states in Mexico.
Well, Nancy, let's turn now to the results of the Mexican Reintegration Project study. What were some of the factors that made returning to Mexico especially challenging, or on the other hand, go more smoothly?
The most important thing was whether or not the individual had Mexican identification. And in Mexico, the idea accepted by government offices as well as individuals is the INE card, the Instituto Nacional del Elector, the National Electoral Institute's ID. And it is necessary for everything. If you want to receive money from the states, you need to show this ID. They will not accept any other ID in order to pick up money. If you want to rent an apartment or a room, you have to show your INE ID. If you want to open a bank account, if you want to get a job. And so if individuals do not have this government ID, they're really stuck. They don't have money to buy food. And so we found that individuals, because of a lack of ID, had to stay in shelters or were homeless for a while until they were able to do so. And part of getting the ID is that you have to show another ID, which if they were deported and their identification was not returned, they don't have. They have to show residency, which they've been deported or have just returned, they don't have a place to live, so they don't have proof of residency. And you show proof of residency through a bill or a mortgage payment or a leasing agreement. And so what people ended up doing, if they had family, connecting with family to vouch for them and use their proof of residency, or reach out to non-governmental organizations who often accompany people, by which they mean help them walk through all the requirements and vouch for them that they know this person and they have a proof of residency in order to get an ID, or simply not be able to get an ID and only be able to work in the informal labor market and having to live in the most exploitative and poor conditions possible. Some individuals will rent to you without an ID, but they're going to charge you more and it's going to be a worse situation. So this ID is the linchpin to becoming a citizen in your own country.
Well, Nancy, as a follow-up, what do people do if they're dropped off in the middle of the night and don't have that ID? The people who you studied, what kinds of experiences did they have?
Very scary experiences. The border is also a region where narco traffickers often control the streets. And so they found themselves in situations of violence. We had several participants who said the person next to me was picked off in a car and kidnapped, or I had to run from the bridge in the middle of a shootout. And so they were in the midst of violence. They didn't have an ID in order to go to a hotel or get money. And so they went to bus stations and slept on the ground, though bus stations are recruiting grounds for narcos as well. They walked all night. They sought out shelters. They were in terrible conditions. Another requirement to get your ID is a birth certificate. If you do not have a birth certificate, you must return to your place of origin to obtain it. And we had several groups of men who were deported, did not have their birth certificates, and thus had to go to Chiapas to obtain their birth certificate. However, their communities were embroiled in narco wars and they were trapped there. They could not leave the shelter because the narcos were trying to recruit them to their bands. They could not get a job because the few jobs they were offered, the employers were threatened by narcos. And so, again, getting this ID is very complicated. Another result we found was school papers were another challenge, especially for the returned and the children of the returned. This education department required an apostille on the school records and a certified translation. However, there had been an agreement pushed by nonprofit organizations representing and made up of deported and returned people to not require the apostille, but the government itself and schools were not following this agreement, which is Agreement 286. And so children often had to sit out school for months and even for years while their paperwork was obtained in order for them to continue their education. We also found that mental health support was severely lacking. For many others who returned or were deported and could not find a job to pay for their living expenses, who found that they no longer fit in because they had left Mexico as kids or they never really knew Mexico, that it was very difficult to deal with the stigma of being a deported or returned person. If you chose to return, you were seen as a failed migrant. Why did you go and come back with nothing? If you were deported, you were believed to be a criminal. And even family members would treat them as criminals. And so this meant that deported individuals often reconnected with their family but felt so much stigma and discrimination that then they left to start a life anew but without family. And so return is a difficult process, and individuals who prepared for it by going through the consulate, obtaining ID, finding out what documents they needed to revalidate studies, did better. Deported individuals who had family in Mexico that could go pick them up from the border or Mexico City and bring them home did better, although, as I mentioned, there were challenges there. individuals who spoke fluently in English were able to get the best jobs available. Though working at a call center is stressful and can be demeaning because of the way people treat you, you can make 4 to 5 times the minimum wage, and so therefore you have greater status and you're able to have a better standard of living than even most Mexicans with your same level of education.
If you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm attorney Maria Hall, here with my co-host, constitutional scholar Stephen Rohde. We've been speaking with attorney and law professor Lou Serrera and sociology professor Nancy Planky Videla from Texas A&M University about a published report called The Mexican Reintegration Project Study.
Luce, when you completed the study, you held a conference and came up with recommendations. Who was part of the conference, and what were the key recommendations that you came up with?
Yeah, so as we had previously alluded, we did start this project in 2019. COVID came and it, you know, took all our interviews online. And through that process, we worked with a number of nonprofits that would help identify individuals. And we included some of those nonprofit organizations who helped us get word out in Mexico to identify participants. So we included some of those individuals, but we also included academics from Mexico and the U.S., and we invited a number of elected officials. Those in Mexico did show up. We did have an immigration judge from the United States who also showed up to that. And so it was a variety of individuals that really came to represent different perspectives, different sectors. Some of the recommendations that came out of that was really to help individuals to think about this project and how we address it. As one, having more engagement between the government sector and the nonprofit sector in terms of supporting the people that return or are deported into Mexico, the integration by those who sought the services of the nonprofit organizations was a little bit, not, I won't say easier, but it was better facilitated by having ongoing interaction with individuals at nonprofits. Many of those nonprofits had developed communities of individuals who had experience, who had the similar experience, so there was some community that was formed through that. I think generally we also recommended that there should be more humane policies. There are treaties and memorandums of understanding that the United States and Mexico have that set the times and the time frames for deportation, repatriation of Mexican citizens. And we found, as Nancy alluded to, that some of these practices that were happening in terms of sending folks in the middle of the night to Mexico were really not humane practices, because it would expose them to violence and crime. And so really more humanity in the deportation process, to honor the existing agreements was a big component of that. There was a lot that we thought we could do. One of the things that we talked a lot about was the creation of a binational services network that would help connect not just lawyers, but social service providers across the border to really be able to understand the experiences that happen in both sides. And oftentimes, you know, we know that there are millions and millions of families in the U.S. that are mixed status, which means that people who are deported or returned leave a number of assets and family members, including underage children, in the United States. And so that we need to be able to collaborate internationally and binationally on issues that range from education to custody to vehicles, right? And registering vehicles in one country if you're bringing them from the U.S., for example. There was a lot that we could do. Obviously, we really did think that government played an important role. There was constant discussion about how immigration reform in the U.S. could be something that would help address these issues. For example, having policies that allow for visas, allow families to come to the United States, or individuals to visit families in the United States, might be a way to help discourage the consistent undocumented migration by just providing some opportunity for folks to come and visit and have that be a supervised visit where people are then able to return to Mexico, that would be a way to preserve family ties. And so those were some of the recommendations. I think for me, the biggest takeaway from all of this is that if you are a Mexican national who has immigrated to the United States, that it's important to use the resources of the Mexican consulate in the United States to set up things like identity in Mexico if you were to ever return, whether it's by your own decision or through deportation. And part of the services also include the opportunity for children of Mexican nationals, to become Mexican citizens. And so U.S. children born to Mexican nationals in the United States, having this dual citizenship that allows them the opportunity to fully access the resources in Mexico when they return, whether it's because the family made a conscious effort to return or because one of the parents might have been deported and they want to go visit. It's important to have that documentation done in Mexico as well, even if people are living in the United States, even if they are U.S. citizens, and that can be done through the Mexican consulates.
Luz Herrera, where can listeners find more information about immigration law? And tell us where we can read more about the Mexican Reintegration Project study report and follow your work.
Sure. Well, our work can be found by Googling either Nancy's name or my name and doing a search for under Texas A&M and Mexican Reintegration. There is an English version available that is posted on a research network lab that's available for download. And we are in the process of also uploading the Spanish version of that report that was released in December of 2023. So we do have an upcoming law review article that will be published by one of the journals at Columbia Law School, but that's still a work in progress. In terms of finding additional resources, it's important to look at local organizations based on where you are. There are several national immigration organizations, including the National Immigration Law Center. ACLU has a lot of great resources for people as well. So there are multiple organizations that have put out some really great Know Your Rights information. And based on the state that you're at, you would have different resources. Always look at your local county bar association or local bar association, because oftentimes the immigration sections for those bar organizations also have resources.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today on Law and Disorder. Attorney and law professor Luz Herrera and sociology professor Nancy Planky Videla from Texas A&M University. Thanks again for talking with us about what happens after deportation.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine the 1941 book titled The Dual State, a contribution to the theory of dictatorship, written by German-Jewish socialist lawyer Ernst Frankel. Our guest is Purdue University Professor Emeritus Bill Mullen. He'll concentrate and focus on the dual state theory and what's known as the prerogative power as opposed to normative power, and take a look at the range of parallels that happen between Nazi Germany and what's going on in the USA today.
We next look directly at the record number of journalists who have been killed by Israeli forces while covering the war in Gaza.
Our guest, director and producer Robert Greenwald, documents this brutality of war and brings it to the screen in his new film, Gaza, Journalists Under Fire. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The German-Jewish lawyer Ernst Frankel escaped from fascist Germany and settled in the United States. In 1941, he wrote an extremely important book, which we're going to discuss today. The book is called The Dual State, A Contribution to Theory of Dictatorship. The book explains how Hitler availed himself of two systems of law. The first, Frankel called, the normative state. This is your traditional law that regulates things like contracts and property. It was practiced in Nazi Germany and kept things stable. The second, Frankel called, the prerogative state. These are the arbitrary, violent, and unlawful actions taken by Hitler and his gangs in the streets and the Nazis. These two systems of law existed side by side in Germany. And this is what we see developing now in the United States of America. We speak with returning guest, Purdue University's Professor Emeritus Bill Mullen, on the dual state theory and how it applies to America today. Bill Mullen last appeared on Law and Disorder to speak about the black anti-fascist tradition in our country. He's a contributor to the just-published Law and Disorder book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism American Style. Bill Mullen, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. So glad to be here.
Bill, let's talk about fascism. What is fascism? It's not just a slur word, is it?
No, it's not. If it was just a slur word, the world would be a safer place. I like what Trotsky and Clara Zetkin said about fascism about 100 years ago, when they described it as a political response of capitalism to a crisis which attempts to restore profitability in an order by attacking the working class, diminishing political opposition in all of its forms, reducing civil society, and using the levers of the state to enact power in and all ways in the name of preserving the ruling class power. And that's how I still see it.
Yeah, I remember Jim Cannon, one of the founders of the American Communist Party out of the IWW, said that fascism was peremptory counter-revolution.
Exactly. That's a great description.
Bill, who was Ernst?
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The occupation says that by